Hello everyone, my name is Phil Blancato and I'm CEO and President of Latimer Talman Asset Management. Welcome to another weekly update. Here we are all the way up to September the 23rd. For a fun opening story, I work in New York City and my address is between 47th and 48th Street on Park Avenue. Out of my window, I can see what once was the primary building for J.P. Morgan, a 54-story or so building that they decided, since it was only half of a city block, to take it down to the street level and then rebuild it the entire city block, roughly 44 stories high. I've never seen a building be deconstructed before, and now they're down to about the 38th floor, I'd guess, from being as, you know, roughly 54 floors. But I guess it speaks to American ingenuity that they're taking the building down from inside out, taking the materials through the middle of the building onto a train car that's below the building connected to the New York City train lines, and it's as if it's just slowly disappearing each day. It's amazing what we can do when we put our minds to it. In a time when we need to put our minds to a lot of different things, it seems to be a bit inspirational to see what they're doing there. Oddly enough, because of COVID, they may not be building it back as quickly as they originally thought, but I'm sure someday they'll get around to when things go back to normal. Normal is a new word, right? What is the new normal? How do we understand it? How do we wrap our heads around it? Well, there's a lot happening right now. Traditionally, the month of September is the worst month of the year. It is the only month of the year that has an actual negative market return going back to the 20s. It's the month that has the most volatility. And generally, it's because, one, the summer ended and people come back to work full force. There is absolutely an aspect of that. Two, it's usually predicated to how did we do over the summer and sets us up for election season. The elections always bring some volatility to the marketplace, and it's a precursor. There's an election every year, the big ones every 4 years, but every 2 years there's something significant going on, Senate, House, and so on. So for that reason, there's always some volatility from that. And then, as usually, the September is sort of the gauge for how the year went. And then October, November hit us into spending seasons for holidays, and they can be as good or as bad as the consumer goes. So it's not unusual to have periods like this. Today we had another 2% sell-off in the marketplace, and while the S&P is still up on the year about 2% after today, we've had some bouts of volatility. Some of the big large cap growth names that we've all come to know and love, like Apple and Microsoft and Amazon, are taking it on the chin. As we've talked about in the past, these companies have very high valuation. How much they're trading for price-wise and how much they're earning, there's a pretty big gap. We look at the ratio between the two, and it's some of the widest spread we've seen since the 2000s. And for that reason, giving back some return on these high flyers isn't out of the question. In fact, I think it's normal. Having a 5 to 10% correction in the marketplace from the highs is good. It cleans up some of the euphoria, gets us back to realizing stocks aren't meant to go up every single day. The market has to be selective in what the winners and losers are, and it's going to be predicated on economic growth. And we all know that economic growth right now is kind of spotty. Up until this point, we had one heck of a recovery from the bottom of the recession, just not what, back in March. Generally, to get to the peak of a market, it takes roughly 1,500 days on average for the market to recover during a recession. This time, not only is it the shortest recession in history, it'll also be the fastest stock market recovery in history, with just about 160 days to completely recover. It's pretty phenomenal when you think about it, how far we've come and how fast. When we look back at this historically, I think we'll look back and realize this was like nothing we had ever seen before. And I guess we all knew that going in, and we anticipated it for certain. But there's no doubt when we go back in years to come, when we study this, it'll be moments that happen that we never clearly anticipated. And I think at times like this, when you see the market get wildly volatile, the first thing that comes to mind is, what can I do to protect my assets? Now let's take a minute just to talk about that. Well, certainly I think there's something to be said for the idea of the shortest recovery ever. In fact, it's 126 trading sessions, 127 as of today, trading sessions that got us all the way back. So in that mindset, I want you to think about it this way. Is there a way to time the market? There's this temptation that we see volatility. I've heard so many people say, I want out of the market because, you know, the election's going to be terrible. We're going to have a contested election. And yeah, that'll be volatile, no doubt about it. But in the long run, I liken trying to time the market to playing golf against Tiger Woods. take him, and I know he's a little bit older, so take it with a grain of salt, I guess. Over the course of an 18-hole match, you might hit a few better than shots than he would. Heck, you might even score better on a hole or two. But over the long term, there's basically zero chance of you beating Tiger Woods in golf unless you're a professional, historic golfer, one of the best ever, which I'm going to guess no one on this call is. So for that reason, I think you want to look at moments like this as just part of the course. We are not in the midst of a deep recession anymore. We've come out of the recession. Expectations for growth for the third quarter as of right now are as high as 32% by the Atlanta Fed governors, with the average from Atlanta. There's a number of different governors that make up the Federal Reserve. Those folks from Atlanta think we're going to grow 32% in the third quarter to as low as 20% in different areas of the country. On average, probably a 25% growth rate for that third quarter. Now, we won't recover everything that we lost. Think of it this way. If you have a dollar and it goes down by 50 cents to if you have a dollar and it goes down by 50%, to make it go back to a dollar, it's got to go up by 100%, 50 cents times two. So in that sense, we create ourselves a real deep hole in that second quarter of the year. We went down by 9%. To recover completely from that hole, we've got to have not only 9% in this quarter, but probably follow along with another 8 or 5 or down the road here. We got to recover completely something like 14 to 15% to make up for the loss. So we've got a long way to go, and we've come a long way so far. But my point is, when you think about the last 20 years, the number one asset class, believe it or not, is REITs. They've returned over 11%. The S&P 500, just about 6% for the last 20 years. A 60-40 portfolio of stocks and bonds, 5.6%. And that's not done by timing the market. So yes, there's when volatility comes, there's some things you can do. Maybe increase your cash a little bit. Maybe take some riskiness out of the portfolio. Maybe rebalance the account so you're back in line with being in a diversified approach. But certainly, you want to make sure you're not trying to outthink the market, because it just can't be done. When we watch what the Federal Reserve is doing right now, part of the reason why the market has been so supportive is that the Federal Reserve has basically come out and said that they're willing to hold interest rates at or near zero for at least the next 3 years. It's incredible to think about how much the Fed has done up until this point. Think of it this way. The federal government has basically pumped $2.3 trillion in lending to a variety of different households and businesses. Additionally, we've backed up the bond market with an additional $6 trillion. Now, that money can be paid off eventually by selling those bonds. They're buying bonds in the bond market to make that happen. But they're creating liquidity by doing that. They've promised money to municipalities, and they've provided people with loans. You lump all this together, and what you end up with, when the Federal Reserve has done so much, how much more can they do? But it is part of the reason why we've gotten this far. So if someone was trying to time the market, they would have left the market back in March, probably not re-entered because we were in the worst recession, arguably the worst moment, one of the worst moments of our lifetime, not re-entered. But there's always a reason why the market will rally. The market's rallying on the idea that the federal government has come to the rescue, that medicine will eventually win, and in fact, the data around the economy isn't as bad as expected. With actually retail sales, how much you all the consumer spend, believe it or not, year over year, we are now back to even on retail sales. Now, don't get me wrong, we had a 17% return to retail sales in the month of May, around an 8% in the month of June, around 6% in the month of July, and then basically down to about 1% in the month of August. The number's getting weaker because the stimulus checks are going away. But certainly, there's something to think about when you look at why we've gotten this far this fast. You can't time the market. Know that the federal government is there to support it, but we need new data to get us to grind higher, new positive data. And the reason why we're having volatility is there's no second round of stimulus as of yet. We can't seem to get an agreement between the Republicans and the Democrats, and specifically between the Senate and the House. We don't have great economic data. It's waned a bit here as the stimulus is worn off. So we're not recessing again, and we're having one heck of growth in the third quarter, but projections for the fourth quarter and thereon after are less lackluster because we're not out of the woods yet from a vaccine standpoint. We're not fully open as an economy. We're doing better, but we're not quite there yet. So for that reason, the market's found its footing in volatility. So my point is, I don't think you want to worry too much about this. Hopefully, you're in a neutral position in your portfolio. You're participating in equity markets, but you're not overbetting on risky assets. Hopefully, you have some higher quality bonds in the portfolio to stem some of the volatility, and that you're rotating towards stocks that pay a nice dividend, like value stocks. call it being paid to wait around for something to happen. Just think, the dividends you can earn in the S&P 500 in some stocks are north of 3 and 4% versus owning a 10-year bond yielding 0.66 as of today. So it makes more sense to own good quality stocks that pay a nice dividend rather than bonds that aren't going to pay that much. The trick is to have a balance of both. Treasuries will help take out volatility in the portfolio. Large cap value stocks will help earn you some yield. Large cap growth, which are still the leaders, will continue to do well, but this is a chance to take some profits and rotate towards other areas that will help protect you in these bouts of volatility. So my opening salvo is just that. This is normal. Accept some volatility. It's a good thing. Gives us a chance to rotate into different stocks, maybe buy some names cheaper, clean up our portfolio, and wait for the next shoe to drop on either economic data or the vaccine front. And on that note, let's jump to the latest on the virus. Certainly, things aren't a heck of a lot better. Unfortunately, you know, we're closing in on almost 30 million cases. Almost 32 million cases confirmed globally. Of that, we're closing on 1 million deaths. Today, we're about 980,000. We'll cross that line, that mark, sometime in the next 7 to 10 days. When you think about the total active cases in the United States, which stands at right about 7.5 million, we have had some significant improvement here. The global fatality rate today is right about 3.06%. That is taking the total number of cases divided by the total number of deaths. That number continues to come down. So what we continue to see as new cases go higher all around the world, Europe is going through a significant second wave, what we're not yet seeing is a significant spike in fatalities. Recent information put out by the CDC says that if you're between the age of 0 to 19 years old, your chance of passing away after getting infected by the virus is 0.003. Your chance of passing away between 20 and 49 after getting the virus is 0.02. Your chance of passing away between 50 and 69 is 0.5, half of 1%. And your chance of passing away in 70 or older is 5.4%. So when you think about it in that context, most people who get this virus are not going to pass away. Think of it this way. 32 million people have gotten the virus, and just about 980,000 have passed away. So the numbers stand in your favor. If you get sick, there's a good chance you're not going to die. Very good chance. Extremely high chance. Add to that whether it's the steroids that are out in the world today that are helping, or drugs like remdesivir by Gilead are all helping bring down the fatality rate. Globally, there's now 5 different vaccines that are approved for use, for emergency use or limited use application, first-line people or people in certain communities. Those drugs are CanSino. Sinopharm has 2 of them, so Sinopharm 1 and 2, a Russian drug, and another Chinese drug named Sinovac. China now has 4 different vaccines that are being used on a limited use basis. Russia has 1. Russia, in fact, has become very aggressive in theirs and now selling it to 10 other countries. Now, the knock on these 5 is that how thoroughly have they been tested? And that's where some of the concern has been, that even though there are other countries with vaccines and they're beginning to use them, how good is their testing? Well, that's interesting, because in the United States, we've had a lot of concern around testing and whether or not folks will take the vaccine if they get sick. And I can understand the trepidation, but if you're getting sick or you need the antivirus or the vaccine to help you get better, I'm pretty certain most folks are going to take it if it means life or death to them, or the chance of recovering or non-recovering. So in that sense, I think there's a lot of news around the vaccines and what's happening, and there should be some reason for euphoria. Just today, for example, Johnson & Johnson came out, which is obviously a very strong American-based firm, global firm in and of itself, but they have moved quite rapidly to catch up to everyone else in the vaccine front. Today, they announced they're going to enroll 60,000 people in their phase 3 trial. What's interesting about what Johnson & Johnson does, it's a single-dose product that doesn't have to be held in frozen temperatures. The knock on Pfizer-BioNTech is theirs has to be frozen. Moderna also has to be kept very cold. This doesn't need exceptional cold temperatures. In fact, it can use the existing infrastructure for vaccines to use it. The United States has already given Johnson & Johnson $1 billion to create 100 million vials of their vaccine. What they found is that in early studies, it had been highly effective at creating antibodies in the body, creating a recovery, and being able to not only vaccinate people, but get them better. They use the same process they use with Ebola, And it turns out they may have the vaccine available for us by December. Now, that's a little bit later than some of the other companies out there, but that's great news considering that we don't have a vaccine or an antibody yet that can we can effectively use to control this. The good news is the most recent data in the United States continues to improve. Not as good as we once were. Now we're down to, in the last 7 days, our average new case rate's about 41,000 cases per day. But in the last 3 days, it's down to 33,000 cases per day. Now, that number hasn't improved a heck of a lot recently, but it's a significant improvement from where we were about a month and a half ago. The good news is our fatality rate is down to 721 people a day, and our 3-day fatality rate is down to about 300 people a day. We are improving significantly on the fatality standpoint. The reality is many of the new people who are getting it are people in colleges, universities, to a degree schools, and then there are spikes in certain states like Wisconsin that's seeing a bit of a spike there. I know there's a concern about certain states, but when I look at South Dakota and North Dakota, for example, their average infection rate was between 50 and 100 for a long period of time. Each of them spiked up to about 400 people per day, and now they've come back down. So, yeah, there's a spike there, but my gosh, that's nothing compared to the thousands that have happened in other places like New York, California, Florida, and so on. So a second wave, but nothing nearly as significant, and that's why our numbers are improving overall. And in fact, it looks like as of late, they're already getting control of it because there's not that many people in those states, so it doesn't take long to get control of it if they put some protections in place. I think the most exciting thing about it is where, as our death rate improves, the fact of the matter is we're able to control the spread better than we have in a while. Granted, we still got some fits and starts to go through, but in that front, things are looking better, and it's showing up in hospitalizations. As of right now, hospital bed occupancy, there are only 2 states in the country that have more than 10% of their people, less than 15% of the people in it due to COVID. The rest are either between 5 and 9% or 0 to 5%. So this is all showing through in hospital data. The million-dollar question is, can we keep our economy going? Can we keep ourselves open? Are we going to get third wave or second wave? And if so, how do we do that? So far, all things are good. We're not seeing a massive spike in the high schools, which are opened up. We are seeing some in the colleges. But it seems like even if that's getting reined in, look at the Notre Dame-Purdue game, I believe, which is going to be canceled this weekend because a few kids got the virus. So the measures putting in place seem to be working to control some of what's going on. However, when you look at what's going on, as I mentioned, there's a couple of states like Iowa and Kansas that have a bit of a spike, but nothing concerning. When you compare us to the rest of the world, or in this case specifically Europe, the daily positivity testing rate, meaning for every person they test, how many of those people are positive? Spain is now back up at 12%. France, believe it or not, is back up at 6%. And the United States is below 5%. So our daily testing rate, positivity rate, is now lower than Europe. Go one further. We now have, especially the last 3 days, around 33,000 cases per day. That number is now below Europe. Now, can you imagine, for all the talk about how much better Europe did versus the United States, there was a big knock that their rates had gone down to basically almost zero. And we were still quite high. Well, to our credit, we seem to have done enough smart things, wearing masks, getting people to behave in public, being better about how we manage this process. Our daily new case rate is now lower than Europe, and it has been on and off for the past week here, and I think that's a really interesting sign. Heck, even places like Canada are spiking back up again, much to my surprise, being up nearly 1,000 cases a day from when they were negative, having more people get better than get sick. And somewhere like France with over 10,000 new cases per day on average recently, Spain nearly 12,000 cases per day recently, even the UK back up to 4,000 cases per day. So there's something to be said for what's happening recently, but it also something to be said that this is a very stubborn virus. It doesn't want to go away. So as much as we had hoped there'd be a herd immunity or the virus would weaken, as of right now, we're still seeing it spread. But there is quite a few reports now that the virus is weakening because the fatality rate in Europe is still very low. They've had a minor tick up in fatalities, but nothing near where they were. In fact, they've had days where they have more new cases per day than they did at the peak of the virus, and their fatality rate is nowhere near where they were. Why they're protecting the elderly? This is mostly younger people who were partying in the month of August when everybody was off getting the virus. There are places in the world that are still hotspots, like India, now 70,000 cases a day. On this projection, they'll actually pass us in total number of cases in short order here, probably in the next 10 to 12 days. Brazil has improved a bit, down to 30,000 cases a day from 50, but still very high. Mexico has improved quite a bit from 7,000 cases a day down to 4,000. My point being, around the world, there's still a lot of cases being that are happening, and the economies are impacted by it. How fast can you open? Are you able to open? For example, in the UK, they're shutting down pubs to where the time they can open can only be between 10 and 5. 10 p.m. to 5 p.m., or 5 p.m. to 10 p.m., I should say. By the way, I find that a bit strange. If you shrink the number of hours pubs and restaurants can be open, doesn't that mean more people are going to go in between those hours, making it more crowded, making it more likely that people would get it? Wouldn't it make more sense to make the hours longer so less people are in the pub at less of the time? Not sure, actually. I guess the idea is that less people have time to go, so less people would go. But just something to think about as a common sense point of view. They are fining people up to $200 a fine for not wearing a mask, and £200 for not wearing a mask, and £10,000 for restaurants and bars that don't meet the requirements. So quite significant draconian move there. France and Spain are also considering doing the exact same thing. So this virus is being quite stubborn, does not want to go away. When I look at some of the other things that are going on around the world, you know, there is some sense to what's happened. Meaning, when you look at New Jersey has one-fourth of the new cases. One-fourth of the cases of, say, California. Yet, in New Jersey, there's been more people who have passed away from the virus than in California. New York has two times as many people have passed away versus California, but less cases. So the majority of the people who were impacted from a fatality standpoint really was New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts. If you take them out of the picture, the numbers increasingly better around the country, and that's part of the reason why we're able to manage this, the death rate here, the fatality rate, and that shows because New Jersey has improved, and so has New York and Connecticut. So that's part of it. But I did read a quote this weekend that resonated with me, and I think sometimes it's easy to forget about who's most affected. Michael Luzardo, Deputy Director of Emerging Pathogens at the Institute, at the University of Florida, said in a quote, "Behind all the numbers, the 200,000 plus people that have passed away, there are families, loved ones, and groups that will mourn them for years to come." And then that is very true. It's sad what's happened. Nearly a million people dying around the world from this terrible disease, and affecting us both personally and economically. I did read one additional report that talked about how the federal government specifically has created an agency, a vaccine advisory committee, to be able to not only decide which vaccines are ready for emergency use, but also who should get them, as well as bringing in consultants and having numerous working groups so that they will have a very strict review before anything is allowed out from the idea of emergency use application. I know there's a lot of concern about this, but certainly it seems like the CDC and the federal government are putting outside and inside consultants in play to make sure there's not a problem with the overall releasing of these vaccines. And I guess I'll go back to where I started. I just don't see how a Pfizer or a Johnson & Johnson would bring a drug to market that's not thoroughly tested and able to use globally. The impact, my gosh, you'd bankrupt any of those companies if they ever did something that was not prudent. So I'm less worried about the efficacy, but I do think it's great that the federal government's saying we're not going to rush this through. We're just going to bring in more people to get it done more quickly. Neat study by the Defense Department. They're giving troops, 1,000 of them, a special ring that connects to a smartwatch. They do this in the NBA as well. That can be an early detector based on your biorhythms, meaning did you get the disease and what's changing, and know when someone gets it very early on. Maybe we're all going to have to wear some sort of patch on our body to say, hey, you're getting a spike in your biorhythm, so you may have the disease, go get tested. There's a lot of different things in place here that I think are very interesting, it's amazing when we think about it. From a testing standpoint, one piece of bad news, it seems like we're running out of the materials needed for this significant ramp up in testing. I mean, we went from 15 million tests in the month of April to almost 38 million last month. So we've tested more people than anyone in the world other than China, and I'm not sure we can believe China's data. But for that reason, I think it stands to raise some concern that as of right now, you know, there is we're running out of the materials needed. Unfortunately, a lot of these materials come from China. So we're going to have to figure this out before, because we're going to have to test that much more. Even Abbott Labs, who's come out with a rapid test, is saying they can deliver the test, but they don't have enough materials to do it. So that's something to be concerned about as we go into the fall here and have a potential second wave. A few more updates about the virus and about economics. Just one quick thing I picked up. The Pew Research Center said that back in May, 72% of people said they would take a vaccine. Now that number is down to 50. So that's somewhat disappointing that we're seeing more and more folks shy away from the vaccine. I come back to the same thing. If somebody's sick, I'm pretty certain that they're going to consider taking it to get better. I think that goes fairly certain of that, actually, but maybe that's just my opinion there. So let's be careful of that. Pfizer did come out and say that they look like they're going to be the first one to market with their vaccine, backed up by the federal government. As I mentioned, Russia is now working with numerous other countries to sell their vaccine. And the news on Johnson & Johnson this morning, very powerful. Sanofi just signed a deal to sell 300 million doses of theirs, which is really early in production, to the EU. That makes sense, though. It's a French-based company trying to have a European company help Europeans. Makes sense, because you want to make sure your own population is okay right out of the gates. And the other piece of news that I think was very interesting is that Eli Lilly, which is a therapeutic I'm very high on, came out and said not only are they excited about the speed that they got their therapeutic to market, which normally takes years, they got done in 6 months, that their therapeutic is 72% effective. It is having to be done with two different intravenous injections, so that's a little bit problematic. But they are teaming up with other drug manufacturers to be able to produce their therapeutic faster, and they're sharing their results with other companies who are also making therapeutics. Therapeutics is, you know, you're not feeling well, you go to the doctor and they give you a pill, a drug, a shot, and you get better. So I think that's exciting news on that front, that there is movement on the therapeutics. Not as much as we'd like. We just need these things to come out faster, and they're not quite here yet. Regeneron's the one that I've always believed would be the first to market to help us with something simple that we can take to get better. Eli Lilly has one. It's just a matter of whether we can produce it or not and get it into the market. More to come on that. So when you sum up the virus, the vaccines and the antibodies, progress, maybe not as much as we'd like, but certainly progress there as we continue to find every single week some progress. A bit more on data. One of the things that's happened recently is we've seen a real improvement in housing. And I want to take a minute just to talk about housing. Believe it or not, the housing market continues to be very strong. Mortgage demand is up 25% from a year ago. Take this one further. The average home in the United States is up 8.8% versus last year. You know, that's a significant jump. The average home is now $310,000. We're seeing the supply of unsold homes fall to 3 months. Anything below 5 months is already considered a tight market. So in that sense, it really is pretty incredible what's happening in the housing market. Housing is very important because when it comes to housing, it's accretive to GDP. More people go to work, more buying and selling, materials needed, people building homes, people selling homes, banks make money. It creates movement in the economy. All that is a very positive thing to see so much success in the housing market and the increase in price. Your home is your most valuable asset. And for people to make more money on the sale of it means they have an opportunity to spend more. Remember, we're a consumer-based economy. When the consumer is strong and getting stronger as of late, when the consumer is strong, we used to do well. Now, we still have, unfortunately, around 8 to 11 million people out of work, and that's our Achilles heel right now, that we still haven't gotten the restaurants, the hotels, the leisure components of our economy up and running, and that's what's holding us back. When you look at weekly jobless claims, they're still coming in around 850,000 people a week are applying for unemployment benefits. That's a terrible number. Then the total number of people unemployed is still around, like I said, 8 million or plus. I'd have to say, argue it's more like 11 million. If you count those people who are no longer counted or out of the workforce, it could be as much as 20 million. So let's be careful about getting too far ahead of ourselves. But as of now, the data on sales, homes, the consumer spending are good enough to keep us opening up and growing. It's whether or not we can open up further and get more people back to work that's going to be the critical component of how we do economically, which translates into stock market success and bond market success through the rest of the year. Some other things that have come out that I think are really important: consumer confidence, critical, because how confident consumers are is how much they spend. We saw another uptick in confidence, a measure up to 79% consumer confidence from 75%. That's a scale of, say, 50 to 100, and we're not quite at the highs we were before this happened, but starting to look much better. When you think about the overall makeup of the consumer, people will spend when they're confident. One thing that did come out, though, was they surveyed who the consumers, of the people they surveyed, who they thought was going to win the election. It was actually 48 versus 47, almost a statistical tie. And that going back to 1976, the consumer in this survey has been right on who picked on who they thought was going to win the election every single time. So with the consumer being at a draw speaks to we're going to have a lot of uncertainty going into this election because there's no clear-cut winner as of now. And hopefully it doesn't become a contested election where we're having to rely on mail-in ballots for an answer. Hopefully that's not the case, but certainly something to consider. I did notice that the economy is in expansion mode. We look at a gauge called leading economic indicators. It's 10 factors of the economy, like housing starts and building permits and hours worked. And that's back in expansion mode after significant contraction over the last few months. So that's a good sign that we are opening up and seeing more success around the strength of the U.S. economy and specifically where we see our growth coming from. When you put it all together, the S&P is still up on the year. After today, down 4% for the last week, and after today, only up about 2%, certainly there's some reasons for concern. But volatility this time of year is normal, as we talked about earlier. We're still waiting for the vaccine. It's critical. We need to be able to have a therapeutic or vaccine that lets us open up fully. And until that point, you should expect volatility. We're still waiting on the federal government to do something along the lines of stimulus, some more money to help businesses that are suffering. Believe it or not, there's an estimate right now that 164,000 businesses have closed since March 1st. And of those, almost 98,000 will never reopen. Small business is the engine of the U.S. economy. It's the one that employs the most people. And we're seeing that many shutter, it's a problem. Now, in fairness, we've seen an increase in 14% of new business applications this year. So as many as are closing, there's a bunch trying to open. That's a great sign. But to do that, we need a healthier and stronger economy, and we need to be able to get people back to work. And therein lies the quandary we're in. Waiting on the federal government for help, waiting on a vaccine, waiting on an election. And in time periods like this, when you're waiting, what you should try and do is earn your income, play the middle of the fairway but not taking on too much risk. Make sure your portfolio is well balanced. Take your profits when you get them. And know that there'll be better days to come once we get some answers on the election, which we'll eventually get, on the virus and the vaccine, which we should get this year, eventually at least, and when we can finally open up fully again. Better days ahead, but certainly another week of waiting for more information. Hopefully the call was helpful for you today. Hopefully this information helps you understand the latest and greatest in the market, the economy, and the virus. I look forward to speaking to you again next week. Take care. And have a wonderful fall, everybody. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.